guys, welcome back to The Wall Podcast, hosted by me, Stephanie O'Quigley. If this isn't the first episode that you've tuned into, I so appreciate the return and I really hope that you're enjoying the podcast so far. This, obviously, is an interview with Caroline Foran. She is a best-selling Irish author. Her book, Owning It, was on the book charts in Ireland for 16 consecutive weeks at number one. She has since launched a book called The Confidence Kit and has been just as successful. When Caroline came to the US to launch her book, which they tweaked to call Own It here in the US, she spent some time in New York and I got to sit down with her and record this podcast, which I was very excited about. And Caroline is just as genuine and as kind and as open and as funny in real life as she comes across on Instagram and on TV and on radio. So if you haven't seen Caroline's books, Owning It or The Confidence Kit, I'm sure that you've seen her on TV, on the radio, on Instagram. I'm sure that you've seen her personality out there because she has been all over the Irish media as of late. And I have genuinely been a fan of her book since her launch in 2017. And it's just great to see the continued growth of Caroline's success and how genuine she is. I think that this episode is going to be beneficial to anybody who consider themselves an anxiety sufferer or somebody who just has a little bit too much worry than they'd like. Caroline has kept it so genuine and has spoke from the first person in both her books. And I think that's why people really relate to her. I got to sit down with Caroline and really chat about life with anxiety and how to deal with it. And I suppose that's what her books are all about. It's how to deal with anxiety from somebody who has actually gone through it and not necessarily from somebody who's a doctor or a therapist. Not that that's not helpful, but it just kind of always gives you more of a relaxed feeling and an empathetic feeling when you're talking to somebody who has gone through it and is just a normal person like you are and is just trying to understand anxiety just like you. So I really hope you enjoy this episode with Caroline. It's a very casual chat. I hope that you get something out of it and please do tune in again for the next interview on The Wall.
So I think with the first book, with Owning It, or Own It over here in New York, where we are right now, if you can hear the cars outside.
There'll be a few sirens in this podcast, for sure.
I think the nature of the content is that there's such a sense of urgency with anxiety. People really, if you're struggling with anxiety to the extent that I was, you want to know what it is that might help you. So the book just sort of took off. And I think then the second book, which was about confidence and the fear of failure, while I actually think that book is better, mm-hmm. and I was probably a little bit more proud of that book, there's not as much of a sense of I need this now. So I think I could kind of understand and rationalize why it wasn't going to do quite as well. But it's been a very steady seller and I'm really happy with that as a follow-up to the first book. But like I say, there's just like I need this now with Owning It if you have anxiety.
Yeah, I agree. And it's kind of one of those books that you kind of come back to, like as I was saying, my brother, you know, has his fair share of anxiety. He'd probably kill me for saying that. But I mean, everyone does, I feel like. But he would have little, those little sticker things that you can, those luminous little sticker things, and you can kind of plug pages and you kind of close it and you go back to it. And the confidence kit is on my nightstand, or my locker or nightstand, as they call it over here.
My nightstand.
And it's kind of one, I'll almost just open it and I'll read a pointer or your tips or whatever, like to see, you know, like you have to remind yourself, and I know you talk about this a lot, and I know your husband is great for kind of saying sit down there,
read
and
your
and
own
remind
book.
Yourself
I know.
Like, yeah,
well, that's what I wanted, was with both books, that they were things that you could kind of go back to and check up on and just maybe, you know, put a little marker on the page or like you say, the little illuminated bit of paper to come back to something. And I actually do have to do it myself sometimes, but I think the confidence kit is something, if you don't experience anxiety, but everyone has confidence issues and everyone has the fear of failure, so that actually has kind of a broader appeal. And I think everyone needs reminders all the time to check in with themselves on, you know, some stuff like imposter syndrome or all that kind of stuff. So I think the second book is definitely one that you can just keep beside your bed and go back to whenever you need to.
One of the I mean, this is the start of your journey, but I just found this so relatable, was the way that you talked about your childhood and how the anxiety began to manifest itself when you were so young. And I just feel like a lot of parents need to hear that. Not that, you know, we're not, you know, it's not about good parenting, but it's just about that awareness.
Yeah.
You talked about being so young and calling it a sick feeling in your stomach. And I related to that so much because when I was younger, like, again, going back to that thing, you'll be grand. Mm. Like, I want to write a book called You'll Be Grand. Because it's just, it's a killer. It's a little bit of a killer, like.
Yeah.
But talk to me about the sick feeling in your stomach and how actually young you were at that point.
I think I've always had tummy issues. So I mean, going back as early as I can remember, like 5, 6, 7, I remember specifically feeling unwell whenever I was, I guess, a little bit uncomfortable. So times when my parents would have had to go away and they'd leave me at my nana and granddad's house. And
change
something. Just something like that where I was like, I want my mammy. And instead of realizing that I want my mammy or realizing that I was a little bit like I wanted my comforts, I would just not feel well because that's how it manifested for me. And I think for a lot of kids, especially, it's tummy issues. I have one of my best friends, her little girl, she's the most bright, confident little girl in the world. And when she goes into school in the mornings, she's got this little kind of worry around being late for school. She doesn't like if she's late or she doesn't like going into the classroom. She doesn't know that, but every time she goes to the classroom, she says to her mom, I have a pain in my tummy, I don't want to go to school today. And she goes in and then she's fine.
Yeah.
So she doesn't have the awareness, but I have the awareness to say to my friend, and my friend has the awareness now as well because of the kind of conversations we're having, is it's just a little anxiety or worry. But back then when I was a kid, you know, it was like, don't be silly, you know, you're with your nana and granddad. Or even because I didn't identify it as fear, it was like, oh, you just had too much chocolate, or, you know, maybe it's this thing that doesn't agree with you, or you'll be fine in a while. And that kind of stuff just sets in. What happens, I think what's so important for parents to realise, something I didn't realise, is that, and I spoke about this at the launch event, we have a very strong ability to feel fear when we're young and have things kind of embed into our long-term memory. But we don't have the ability yet, until maybe, like, sometimes it's not till like 10 or 11, our logic and reason hasn't quite developed yet. So you might have a scary experience at 6 or 7. To an adult, it seems ridiculous. So, for example, there's a monster under my bed, or, you know, something that seems so innocuous that to a kid is absolutely terrifying. They can't rationalize that. So what happens is that little fear response can sometimes, if it's not dealt with, and this is not to terrify parents, but it can kind of start to just sow the seed of a little sort of predisposition towards worries and fear and anxiety. Mm. And it's really unfortunate that it happens that way. So that shows me that there's a really crucial time period when a kid is starting to be able to think about things as being scary, but not able to rationalize them as an adult would. And it's in that time frame that you need to sort of take a kid seriously. And for me, it was things like, you know, oh, being told, now it's time to go to bed, go up and put your pajamas on, do your teeth. And I just remember being like, oh, you know, every kid has that fear of like going upstairs and it's dark and on my own. And I used to be just so afraid in my bedroom trying to go to sleep when my parents were still downstairs. And my brother was a bit older than me. So only when he would come home and come up to bed, then I would relax and fall asleep. So all these kind of little things that seem so like, oh, don't be silly, you're just, you're fine. Or my grandparents dying was a huge thing for me. I think I remember such silly things that parents, they mean well, and like, you know, things like, oh, your nana's still with you, and I was like, what? I don't want her to be fucking with me. She's a ghost. Like,
yeah.
I couldn't rationalize death. I couldn't understand it. And suddenly I was in my nana's house with my granddad, where, you know, my parents had to go away or for whatever. My parents worked really hard, and I completely respect that and appreciate that they did that to give us the best of everything, you know. But I remember being in the house and being like, my nana was here and now she's not here. And then my granddad was like, right, time to go to bed. And I'm upstairs being like, where's my nana? She's a ghost. She's gonna, you know.
Yeah.
And that was not, it wasn't comforting to me to think that my nana was still with me. So I just know those kind of experiences start to set in. But for me, it was like, I don't feel well, I don't feel well, I don't feel well.
Right.
So no one ever realized that it was fear.
Yeah. And what does your mother say now about kind of reflecting on that? And you recognize that now as an adult, to being able to rationalize, as you say. Does your mother say, do you have siblings, and your mother says, well, you know, you clocked it a little bit differently to your siblings. They might have went through the same thing and you might have clocked it differently. You know, did that
yeah,
kind of...
I think so. I've one brother who's like 5.5, 6 years older than me, and he never really had the little fears that I have. He had a different kind of anxiety. He had a stammer, so his mind was completely preoccupied with being able to say his name right, where I was thinking so deeply. And I think, and he's very logical and he's very mathematical, and I'm very creative, and I sort of think sometimes that anxiety, it can be quite common with people who've got such wild imaginations. And I was big into drawing and stories, and I think sometimes if your mind can go to places, it can go to scary places. And I think my mom these days, and I'm always so, you know, eager to say, it's no one's fault, never want to blame her, but she now is like, I just wish I'd known, kind of, I'd understand or understood the nature of anxiety and understood your little worries. And I mean, really, it could have been as simple as I just needed a little bit more reassurance and comfort from my mom, I don't want to blame her, but none of us knew. And also, she probably didn't know that I was... It was all anyone ever said about me was, Caroline has a bit of a dicky tummy. So that's something tangible. That's something that's nobody's fault. That's something that, you know, you just, it's what you put into your tummy, what comes out of your tummy. It's not nothing more than that. And
it's
only,
not emotional.
It's not emotional. And I just think, I don't know, I hope that when I have kids now, if I'm lucky enough to have kids, that I'd have the awareness to come down to their level and be like, not just say, ah, you're grand, like we said, or not just say, and again, it's not bad parenting, like it's a lack of awareness. And I think it's really important now that parents are aware. And I believe that if you get in there at that age and don't tell them to be silly, or don't tell them they're being stupid, and be like, okay, so you're a little bit, maybe you're feeling a little bit afraid, maybe if your kid is saying, coming home from school, being like, I don't feel well, is there someone in school, or how do you feel right now, like talking about their feelings, not to the point that you want to analyze their every mood and wrap them in cotton wool, but just open up that dialogue where they can maybe sort of work through it, and maybe the kid doesn't even realize they're working through it.
Yeah, that's it. And I've no doubt that even you know, with your books, but also yourself, has helped, you know, parents and people our age, I suppose, who haven't had kids yet, to be more aware of, you know, the next generation ahead. And again, it's just awareness, because I think a lot of parents have that commonality of, you'll be grand. And
it's an Irish thing.
It is.
It's a British thing, like a British stiff upper lip thing. And I mean,
we're very like, it goes back to, like, I don't know, like all those old plays. I went to see Juno and the Peacock.
Oh yeah.
Like recently.
I fell asleep during that.
I mean, if it's done well, it's done well.
Yeah.
But it goes back to that. When I try and explain the Irish culture to American people over here, and I say, everything we do is indirect. We do not go straight to the point. You know, it's all, we dance around it, and it's all, yeah, you're grand, you're fine. And they don't even say the word grand.
No,
they can't even.
They think of it as grand is like luxurious.
It's luxurious, yeah. And you're like, no, it's not. Your grand could be like, you know, you're not grand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. So take me, tell me about the point where you realized that you were open to that bit of vulnerability. So you were a kid, you were super, super ill, you kind of had these things going on in your head, you weren't realizing what was happening, but obviously this was all the anxiety clocking throughout the years. Tell me about a part where you kind of said, oh, like I
it's
my
anxiety
head. Yeah, it's not my stomach, it's my head.
So honestly, it really wasn't until I was like in my mid-20s that I clocked it as anxiety, and I think it had to get so bad before I realized it. For me, it was always tummy issues. So yeah, I had my dicky tummy all through my childhood and in school. And I remember maybe finishing fourth year, fifth year, I don't know what the equivalent is over here in America, but I guess high school.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was at the stage where people were getting really confident and wanting to go away and do J1s and come to America, or be just, you know, go and have a fun holiday away with their friends. And I was like, I thought I wanted to do all that. And then when I would go and do it, I remember I went on a holiday with my friends from school, and I mean, their parents were there, we were still quite young, but we were off kind of doing our own thing at night, and I just, I don't know what it was, I started to feel unwell. Well, I don't know what it was, I was anxious, I was out of my comfort zone, and I started to get really very, my stomach got really quite bad, and then I started experiencing anxiety because of my tummy. So I didn't know which was coming first, and doctors would say to me, and in fairness I should have listened, they were like, oh, are you self-conscious, or, you know, it's all in your head, which was the worst thing I could have been told, because I was like, well, it's, thank you, what am I supposed to do about that? And it felt like a cop-out. And you know, of course I feel anxious and worried and stressed. I can't go through the day without feeling unwell. I can't go out for dinner without having a sick stomach. I can't go away without, and then it, because of that fear, the anxiety was fueling the stomach issues. So I didn't know which one was causing
it
the problem.
It started with the stomach, but it just kept on. It was like a vicious
circle. But it actually started with the anxiety. Yeah. If I go really far back and say, okay, well, I was anxious because I went away and I probably wasn't quite ready. I was a little bit of a vulnerable age where my friends were a little bit ahead of me. I still wanted my comforts. I still was very attached to my mom. Like, I still was obviously craving that comfort from her. And I thought I was ready to kind of fly solo and like be so confident and meet all these boys. But really, my body was like, no, we're not there yet. But yeah. Mentally, I wasn't going to, you know, acknowledge that. But my body, and like I read, there's a book title called Your Body Speaks Your Mind, and I've always believed that.
Yeah.
But I was completely unwilling to connect the dots, and that went on, I mean, all through college. You know, my friends would be into university, my friends would be like going out to parties and going away, and I'd be like, I can't come, my stomach's at me, and people are like, what kind of bug is this that you have it for so long? And I remember being told I had IBS, and I remember I went for like a colonoscopy, and like the cameras go up, down, in, out, everywhere. And I woke up from it and they were like, no, everything's fine, like your gut's fine. And I was so upset that this sounds so stupid, but that they didn't find anything that I could pin the blame on. Because if there was nothing, then what, was I just going mad? Was I making it up? Was I imagining it? Why would anyone want to imagine that or wheel that upon themselves? So that was like a really, really hard time. And then I think I left college, I started my new job, which I loved. I felt, you know, fear and anxiety, I think the same way anyone else does, you know, like new job jitters, or I was interviewing movie stars.
Normal things.
You know, really normal anxiety that's not necessarily bad anxiety. And then I was maybe 24 going on 25, and I was offered this new job, which sounded amazing. And I'd kind of, like, we had this chat before we recorded of just having too much drive than is actually good for you.
Yeah.
And I kind of was pushing, thinking I need to just keep, you know, I'm so motivated. I've, like, where could I go if I keep going? And I really burnt myself out emotionally by doing that. And I started this new job, and it wasn't the job's fault, but it just didn't sit right with me. I was uncomfortable. On every way, like, I just was like, I didn't want to be there. And I started to feel really sick again. And it really wasn't until that got so bad where, you know, I couldn't deny it any longer. And then it was like my body was trying to communicate with me so severely through my tummy. That was like the communication system. And I wasn't getting the message. And I was obsessed with like, oh, is it this? Is it that? Is it, you know, well, my gluten intolerant? Is it this? Is it fluoride in the tap water?
And was it getting worse?
Yeah, it was getting worse and worse and worse, to the point that I couldn't stand up. Like, the cramps in my stomach were so bad. I was like, my digestive system had kind of all but shut down. Like, you know, like on a very practical level, it just wasn't working. I started to unravel. So what was happening was I started to produce all these stress hormones because I wasn't addressing it. I wasn't saying, do you know what, I made a mistake here, this job isn't right for me, I'm gonna leave, because that would have meant admitting that I wasn't able to cope. When, you know, get a grip, like, everyone else can handle jobs that are so much more stressful, you've everything going for you. So I just internalized it, said nothing, kept my mouth shut, but my body was like, no, like, we're not happy, something's got to give here. And then I just remember the obsession with trying to fix something tangible that wasn't there got worse and worse and worse. And, you know, to the point that my body, like my limbs, I remember trying to put on like my mascara and my hands were shaking, and I was getting just really, I was like sensory overload, like things that were loud or bright were stimulating me in ways that I was like, oh, it was like I was physically vulnerable. I mean, even if you touched me, I felt vulnerable. Like, I lost, describe it in the first book as like losing, it's like if the earth suddenly had no ozone layer and you're very vulnerable to all these different factors. That's what I felt like. And I didn't know what was happening. I didn't have a fucking clue. And I was absolutely terrified. And everyone around me was terrified because I didn't know what was going on, so they didn't know what was going on. And I started to have really violent panic attacks, and they were so scary because I was like, where, what's happening to me? Like, where have I gone? I didn't know they were panic attacks. I didn't know it was anxiety. And eventually this shit just hit the fan, and I just physically broke down. Like, hormonally, I was all over the place. I wasn't sleeping. I was, you know, crying all the time. I was getting lost in place. You know, I just couldn't, I literally couldn't put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
And it was really, really scary. And
it took you to the point of breakdown, really, to become, to say, kind of like, what's going on here?
Yeah, it took me to unravel physically and stop functioning to the point that I couldn't even go into work. I couldn't even meet someone for coffee to be like, okay, maybe this is not a digestive issue.
Right.
Maybe this is an emotional issue. But that was something I was so unwilling and didn't want to even comprehend, because that to me meant you really are a weak person.
Yeah.
And there's something wrong with you. And it was just confirming to me, you know, like all those years of like having had a sore tummy when I was a kid, that there was always something amiss.
Yeah.
And that, you know, everyone else around me seemed to have it together, and I was just out of step in some way. And you know, what the hell was wrong with me? And also the biggest fear was, what am I gonna do? Like, is this just my life now? Am I gonna ever? It was absolutely terrifying. And like, obviously, you know, this is something I talk about so much, but even when I bring it up, like, go into it, I'm still quite traumatized that I went through it. And you know, we talk about journey and stuff, and like people say, oh yeah, but look, you know, you've written the books and everything. I'm like, yeah, but
it doesn't mean that everything's okay. It's still,
no, I still kind of really wish I didn't have to go through that.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, I've learned a lot. But I, and it maybe would have,
oh, we have the
some,
sirens, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, there they are. We're in New York City. But it could have happened later on, or for someone else. Like, I try to rationalize to say, you know, people like, why, you know, you'd say to yourself, why does this have to happen to me? Or people say that about something that's really genuinely, someone gets cancer, that's a reason to say, why does this happen to me? So I was like, I had this guilt about falling apart for no good reason. Mm-hmm. You know, which is such a self-perpetuating, self-stigmatizing thing, that what started as anxiety about a job became anxiety about what people think of me, anxiety about how does this make me look that I have anxiety, you know, anxiety about how this would affect my relatively new relationship, anxiety about how I would pay my bills on a very practical level.
So tell me about those thoughts. So obviously a lot of what you're speaking about is it manifests itself as a physical thing.
Mm.
But what was really actually going, like, do you remember the things? Because from my experience with anxiety, and for anyone who doesn't know, I've had the panic attacks. I don't feel like I've been on the scale that you've been on, which is okay, but
it's a whole spectrum.
It is a whole spectrum, but I've definitely had, I mean, my mother's a therapist, so she kind of was able to intervene and say, look, I think this is, you know, I'd say, oh, this is what I'm thinking, and I can't do this anymore. It wasn't as severe, but the panic attacks and then the therapy and everything else. But I remember specifically, like, I remember what I used to think about.
Mm.
Like, I remember what I used to think about, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't think like this anymore. So what was your thoughts in your head?
Yeah, so I think it was equally physical as it was mental, and the mental was terrifying. So my thoughts in my head were, it was never like, oh, you're gonna, you know, people say about panic attack, oh, I thought I was gonna die. My fear wasn't that I was going to die or have a heart attack or anything. That my fear was that I was capable of doing this to myself. My thoughts were, there's something wrong with you, you're weak, you'll never be able to leave the house again.
So you had fear about the fear.
Crucially, that was the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Like, that was the biggest fear. It was like fear of, oh, I such mad thoughts. Whereas, I mean, I couldn't even watch a movie without inserting myself into the character's position and thinking, oh, geez, I couldn't be there where they are right now, or I couldn't handle that. And Barry would be like, yeah, but you're here with me in bed. Like, you're not. And I was just, like, it was like empathy to the, on speed, you know, I was absorbing everything around me. And I was thinking of the worst case scenario. My mind was jumping 10 miles down, you know, the road, thinking, I'm not going to be able to do this thing that I have to do in 6 weeks' time. And, like, all this talk of just be here in the now and be mindful. I was like, I wish I could do that, but I can't, you know? And so every thought, it was like I had anxiety goggles on, and every thought was tinged with fear. And, you know, things like people say, oh, like, let's go for a walk. And I'm like, okay, like, where are we going to go? And what if I panic there? What if I panic? What if?
Yeah.
What if I fall? And eventually that became eventually, a very long time, what if I fall became what if you fly, you know, for me. But it was, I'm mentally unwell. One of my biggest fears was I'm going to end up in a mental institution. I'm going to have to be sectioned. And because of what we see on movies and TV, that just didn't seem like something normal. That seemed like crazy. I didn't want to be crazy. And I felt like people were going to look at me and think I had two heads, or be afraid of me, or think it was contagious. Like, I was afraid of myself. I was afraid. I mean, I got to the point where, I mean, and I left the job, okay? I left the job and I thought people would say, oh, you leave, there's the stressor, take away the stressor, the anxiety will go away. No. And that was even more terrifying because I had suffered stress for so long and left it unaddressed that it didn't just go away overnight. My hormones were in a heap. It was going to take a long time to get back. And because I didn't understand it, I didn't know what was going on, I was constantly adding to it. It's like chewing gum that keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, I couldn't stop it myself. This was a really important point that I, on my journey, that I struggled to make to this point, to this day, I was suffering for such a long time. It wasn't going away overnight. And I was like, I don't want to be like this. I don't want to be here if this is what my existence is going to be. This is not fair. And I'm a burden on everyone. I'm a burden on Barry, my boyfriend at the time. I'm causing so much worry and stress for my family. I'm completely useless as a friend socially. And I was so physically unwell with it, yet couldn't seem to figure out how I could fix it, that I was like, well, if I always sort of, I had these thoughts of like, well, if I can't fix it, I can opt out of life.
Yeah.
And that was a grim,
yeah,
grim point to get to. And I remember I was with a therapist at the time, and they, you know, I knew that I was diagnosed, she diagnosed me with depression as a tick the box kind of, if you're having these thoughts, if you're feeling this way.
I got that quiz as well.
Like, you just can't, it's not like painting by numbers, you know.
It's a one page quiz for anyone who doesn't know.
I know. And then you get that and you're like, oh, is this just the way I am now? Great. You know, yeah. And I just, that's why I'm like really
add up your numbers.
Like, yeah, answers. I'm really, I don't like that kind of thing. I know it's necessary for some people, but even I don't like the word disorder. I feel like that's something that you feel like is stamped on your head that you're stuck with forever, ever more. But I was depressed because I didn't want to be that way. It wasn't that I didn't want to live or be here. I didn't want to feel this anxiety. I didn't want to be this unwell, this mentally unwell. I so wanted to feel better so that I could enjoy my life. That's why I was depressed. And that's why if I couldn't enjoy my life or even live my life or function or leave the house or, you know, what was the fucking point being here then?
Yeah.
So that was why I got to that low point. So yeah, like the thoughts went from, you know, panic to like, don't want to be here. And even to this day, like, I just wish I could go back and give myself a hug. I just wish I could just give myself my book and be like, you're gonna figure this out and you're gonna learn so much and it'll never happen to you again to the same extent because you'll know so much. And little did I know that in my journey of, you know, for me, knowledge was power. It was like understanding, okay, well, I knew, like, I had to get out a pen and paper, but like, where can I start? What can I do? What can I, let's rule out things. Like, sometimes people can have anxiety because of thyroid problems or get your bloods done, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I just don't know where the strength came from, but I just had to get proactive and figure it out. It took me a long time, but little did I know that my efforts in trying to understand it and take the fear away from the fear and know what was going on physiologically and hormonally was going to have such an impact on everyone else who would wind up in a similar situation to me.
Yeah, it's funny because you talk a lot about it from a practical standpoint. And I know you spoke about CBT therapy, which for people who don't know is cognitive behavioral therapy, which I went through as well. And as much as my mother is a spiritual woman and very spiritually connected, which again doesn't mean religion. And I know you touched on that too. When she's talking about anxiety or dealing with, anxiety for her is so practical when it comes to it. It's really the science, and she's not a scientific woman, but when she's dealing with anxiety, it's so scientific. And I love how you talk about the hormones and even women's periods. I think that's all so relevant that can kind of hit you off. But tell me about the cognitive behavioral therapy, because I want people to know that there is such a therapy that can kind of, people, especially people on the lower end of scale who have kind of ongoing anxiety in their life. They mightn't have been as bad as yourself, yeah. but they it's kind of it's unnecessary to feel like that. And there's a fine line between anxiety that's good and anxiety that is kind of interfering with your normal day to day. But I think cognitive behavioral therapy can really, you know,
I think intervene. like you say, like if you're at the point, and it doesn't have to be very severe, but if you're at the point where it's, you know, you're overthinking things, or it's, you know, your anxiety is affecting how you're living your life day to day, or affecting the choices you make, or, you know, how you're feeling, your mood, CBT is, it's not just like, it's not something to consider. I think it's kind of essential. And it's something you can do yourself. You know, it doesn't have to be with a therapist, but it does help to get to wrap your head around it by doing it with a therapist first. And it's a particular modality of psychology that a regular therapist will bring in. They don't have to be a specific CBT therapist, but it's about how your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors all kind of link together. So I think of it as a triangle of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. I'm making a triangle shape here for those who can't see me. And the reason I really liked it was because it wasn't just talking and how you feeling and how you feel and talking around and around circles, about how you feel. I was going to regular talking therapy when I was down in the doldrums, and I was talking about how I was feeling, and I was going around and around, and I was coming away from it feeling absolutely horrific, and I was like, I'm not getting anywhere. I know that I'm feeling crap right now, and I've always been a talker, so it's not like I'm needed to unearth the reason why. I will tell anyone what's going on with me. I needed a solution. I needed to get proactive, and CBT was that for me. It was one of the ways I could get proactive. Like other things would have been things, you know, very practical stuff like taking away sugar and caffeine for a time of a period of time when I was quite sensitive. But CBT was looking at things from a very it's, first of all, it's loads of like science behind it. It's, you know, and I like that grounded in reality stuff. As much as I don't want to dismiss other things that might seem more spiritual, or, you know, it's really just about any of those things can work if they're having an impact on your physiology. And that's, anxiety is all about your physiology and how your emotions are influencing your physiology. So your how your thoughts are affecting your feelings and how your feelings are influencing your behaviors. So it could be, okay, a thought could be, I can't cope. Your feeling is, or your thought, I can't go to this event. Your feeling is jitteriness, anxiety. Your behavior is you avoid going to the thing and you get stuck in a cycle. So it's about focusing in on your thoughts and putting your thoughts on trial.
Yes.
And so you know, you don't have to be suffering with anxiety to the extent that I was, but for example, some of the sort of common mind traps associated with anxiety that we are all experiencing could include things like catastrophizing. So, you know, I say things like, oh, I'm going over to America, or I'm having this event, which I had the launch event, I'm like, no one's gonna come. And then, you know, sometimes I can do it myself, but sometimes it takes someone like Barry to say, what are you doing now? You're catastrophizing. And when I catastrophize, I'm imagining the worst case scenario, and creating the physiology of anxiety, and then that fuels more anxious thoughts. So it's like taking a step back, taking a helicopter approach, looking at your thoughts and putting them on trial. So there's an exercise called cognitive restructuring, where it's like you're kind of splitting yourself in two and looking, okay, what is anxious Caroline saying? And is this a fact or opinion? Is this based on reality? Or is this just anxiety talking? Another common mind trap could be filtering. So that is when, okay, I go on Amazon, I look at my Amazon reviews for the book, and 99% of them are like, this book has changed my life, it's been so helpful. 1% is like, this book is absolute shit. I filter out all the positive and I hone in on the negative.
When the fact is 99% have clicked it 5 stars.
Yeah.
That's the fact.
And we all have a negativity bias, so we're all primed and we've all evolved to focus on the negative as a way of survival, because back in hunter-gatherer times, if you didn't place enough importance on negative things in your life, you might die. Whereas if you didn't need to put as much energy on positive things, such as, you know, food or sex or sleep, because if you missed out on it that one day, you could get it the next day. But if you were kind of a bit asleep to negative stuff, which might have been a threat to your survival, and you were looking the other way, you'd get wiped out. So
survival.
We've always had to be like super sharply aware of negative things, and that has carried through right to today, and that's why we focus on the one negative in a stream of positives. So all those little things are so part of everyone's day-to-day life, and cognitive behavioral therapy helps you to sort of put them on a box, put them in a label, stop berating yourself for it, stop thinking that you're stuck that way, or that's just the way I am. Oh, you can't just say, oh, I just catastrophize everything. that's what you're doing, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can train your brain over time with these exercises to step back and just shift things a little bit, or rebalance them, or observe that that's happening, and then to sort of correct your course.
Yeah.
So
it's really about rational thinking. It's really about breaking down those thoughts and saying, what are fact and what's fiction?
Yeah.
Like the things that we make up in our head when we're in that kind of survival mode is like complete lies.
It's complete lies. And it's so, it's not just thoughts. Like, it influences your feelings physically, and that influences your behavior. So for me, CBT gave me practical tools and exercises. And also, a lot of CBT, if your anxiety is quite bad, like if you're, you know, if you are avoiding certain things, there's experiments that you can do where you could say, okay, I'm going to go to this thing that I'm anxious about, and I'm going to track my thoughts and observe how I'm feeling, and then I'm going to take it back. So, and like, it's sort of like self-analysis. So you're kind of getting somewhere. You can kind of see where you've come from and where you're going. Again, like, it's directional. It's rather than going around on a merry-go-round. That's why I like it.
Yeah.
And I think CBT, you know, it's not like you don't have to go off and sign up for a course of CBT. You can, and I recommend it. But, you know, there's a CBT exercise at the end of every chapter in the book. It's, you could take out a pen and paper right now and do some CBT by just looking at 10 thoughts you had today that were negative and trying to balance them into a little bit more of a realistic view.
Yeah, and that's funny because that was my next question. The CBT I'm hugely passionate about, and I'm so glad that you speak a lot about it, and somebody who's been through it, because people don't understand. People have this kind of negative connotation with going to therapy to begin with,
yeah.
Especially Irish people, unfortunately. I mean, it's definitely,
we think of it as very American.
I know, and they're like telling, you know, over here they're like, oh, my therapist, this and that. We don't have that. That's not our culture, and that's okay. But it's thankfully it's changing.
We're
now
getting
slowly.
There.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
You know, and the cognitive behavioral therapy is part of the holistic approach to, you know, helping yourself and kind of getting yourself to a point where you can live you can manage it. And you spoke in an interview about being able to manage your anxiety is way more liberating than just never having it again.
Well, yeah.
Which is so powerful, really.
That was like the ultimate game changer for
me.
Because when I was really bad, I was desperate for anything that would make it go away. I've talked about this a lot, where I was like, give me the cure, give me the one tablet, the one thing. I was so vulnerable to things that would prey on our vulnerability and say, oh, do this thing and, you know, unlock the secret, or, oh, I know I can, if you, it's like someone who maybe specializes in hypnotism, or not that there's anything wrong with that, or a particular kind of breathing, say, if I change this about you, you'll never have anxiety again. That is not okay, and it's not fair. Yes, these things can help, but anxiety is a stress response. It's not something to cure. It's not I thought of it as a virus or a bug, like Paranormal Activity. And I was so, if I had gotten that right, I never would have gotten to the, I don't think I would have plummeted so hard, because I would have understood it.
Yeah.
So anxiety is something to manage. And when I said, okay, like, I was torturing myself, being like, you should never have taken that job. You know, like, you know, you have that sliding doors moment of, if I just went this way, maybe this never would have happened. Maybe it would. It's a stress response. We all have it. Some of us just feel it more than others. And when you're stressed out for a long time, you're wearing down the logical, rational part of your brain. And that's all that's happening. And it's about saying, okay, I can't change the past. I couldn't go back in time. I couldn't have someone else, you know, tell me not to take that job. And that resistance, that constant I wish, or, you know, I wish I could've, would've, should've, was just creating more anxiety in my body. And when I said, okay, this is where I am right now, and that was the hardest thing. You know, no one wants to accept. I was in a heap. I wasn't functioning. I didn't want to accept that. But only when I started to say, okay, I'm suffering with anxiety. I'm going to wake up tomorrow, I'm probably going to feel horrific. I'm going to go out, I might have a panic attack. But when I started to say, okay, here you are, you know, come at me, do your worst. And when I started to let myself off the hook and say, maybe it makes sense why you're having anxiety. Maybe, you know, maybe you're not a weak person. Maybe for whatever reason, this is just your reality right now. And I started to kind of accept it. And you can even feel my voice starting to relax now. Because
yeah.
I feel like I've talked so much about the point of resistance.
Mm.
And when I started to say, I remember I came across, I'm so New York.
You got a New York accent, you didn't even realize it.
I came across a quote on Pinterest that just said,
good old Pinterest.
Oh, it's great.
For the quotes.
Such a good therapy. And it just said, darling, just fucking own it.
Yeah.
And I was just like,
fuck this.
Okay. Instead of trying to run away from it, instead of trying to think about it as the enemy, be like, okay, my body's obviously trying to tell me something. I need to work with it instead of against it, which is why the book is called Make Your Anxiety Work For You. You're never going to work. It's never going to get better if you're working against it and you're hating yourself and you're thinking you're so weak and this is so shit. Accept it. Own it. It's a life changer.
Yeah. And after all your pieces of your puzzle that you've put together in this kind of round holistic approach is the way I see everyone has their pieces that work for them, whether it's be picking up your book, you know, keeping it on their, you know, keeping it with them, picking it up, picking up your tips, or your, if it's medication that they need to be on, or if they do need to do yoga, whatever works for them, and to have it all to click together and to kind of, that's their kind of piece that they need to kind of to manage it.
Yeah, it's never one thing. It's always going to be holistic, coming at it from different ways. You're going to be coming at it from looking at your lifestyle, looking at what's going on in your life, looking at your relationships. Is there toxic relationships? Looking at your diet. Have you, like, sometimes my friends are experiencing really bad anxiety and I'm like, you're having to eat espresso a day.
Yeah, that's so, me.
But like, sometimes that's all it is. And sometimes what happens is that I can feel physically anxious. Like, I might have symptoms of
shakes from even
carrying a really heavy bag around all day, and then I can feel my hand is a little bit shaky and I immediately think, oh, I'm anxious.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's sometimes
your brain's,
it's not
way
that.
Of kind of thinking that you're anxious, and it, and then it ignites it in your head, and then it's, you're going at it.
So there's a whole set of vulnerability factors which I say can influence it. Maybe you had a chest infection and you're just a little bit below par. Maybe, like I say, maybe you have your period. Like, I go a bit nuts when I have my period. Maybe it's a delayed reaction to something that happened previously. And so all these different things, it could be you benefit from a little bit of yoga, but sitting down with a crippling anxiety and doing a yoga class isn't going to make it go away. You have to address it in all these different ways. And crucially, not just addressing it, but understanding it and knowing why this is happening, knowing how the body functions, knowing how the brain functions. Like, that for me is probably more important than having a matcha latte or doing the thing or having the, you know,
and not knowing why it works for you. My grandfather always said, if you know the solution, you know, it's the quickest way. If you know the problem, it's the quickest way to find the solution. And it's so true.
So even things like medication, like, has such a bad rap that people think it's just slapping a band-aid on it, but, you know,
it's not the case.
It's not the case. It's one way of helping you get your head above water so that you can benefit from your yoga and your walks and your meditation. But medication won't work for you if you do it and don't address the underlying factors. Or maybe, you know, sometimes people really struggle to find a reason for their anxiety. Sometimes there doesn't have to be a great reason.
It can be
for
just
it.
A chemical imbalance.
It just can be a chemical imbalance. Yeah. And so there's a whole, people are coming at it from loads of different angles. People are experiencing it at loads of different levels or places along the spectrum. And people are dealing with it in loads of different ways. And it's whatever works for you. And like I say, you know, my mindfulness can be, you know, tonight when I get into bed, sitting down and binging on Friends. And that just takes me out of my head. It doesn't have to be, I don't have to run across the Manhattan Bridge to like get my endorphins up or get my cortisol down.
Yeah.
I think in a way the wellness industry became a bit of another thing to kind of beat yourself over the head with recently, where it was like getting up at 5 a.m, arranging your porridge to look like a fucking work of art in the morning, or yoga pants to brunch, or, you know, it doesn't have to be your, it can be your wellness, you know.
Yeah. It's so how do you feel day to day now for people who are, they may have just picked up your book, or you're thinking of going out and buying it, and they're kind of going through the journey and they're at the beginning. How do you feel on the other side of things? And I know that it's still not easy, and it probably never will be, you know, an easy solution, but you get better at it.
Yeah, I absolutely feel like, as you would hope with the book title of this, I feel like I'm owning it all the time. Some days you maybe feel like you're just renting it, but I obviously made the decision to write the book, and I was offered the opportunity to do so, and I felt like that was not just an opportunity for me, but to maybe make an impact in the social media world and the mental health world. And I hope that I've had even some tiny imprint on how people feel. And I know that the nature of my work and what I do gives rise to anxiety, and here I am in New York trying to promote the book coming out here, and I've been feeling a little bit anxious because I've built it up quite a lot, and, you know, I feel things greatly, and that's never going to change about me. I'm never going to be flatlined, the most chill person in the world, but I accept that about myself. And, you know, I had like a bit of a tight chest the last few days, and but I understand why, and I know not to panic about it, because I can say, well, first of all, you're in New York, it's pretty hectic, you've been building up to this trip for a very long time, you know, it's a big deal to have a book come out in America, you're used to your comfort zone, you're away from home, you're away from your dog and your husband, and you've been fucking fueling into the caffeine, which, you know, Caroline, is not a good idea for you. So I can kind of say, it's not that I don't ever feel it, I do feel it, and I just sort of know how to pull myself back from it. So there's managing it when it happens, but then there's also, you know, not just, I also try and avoid it a little bit as well. So like I know that certain kinds of lifestyles wouldn't suit me. I know that if I was to work an 80-hour week in some big corporate job, it doesn't work for me. Mm. And it's not necessarily my anxiety, sometimes it's just my personality. And I think that's a really crucial distinction for people to make. And I have a chapter in the book called Know the Difference Between Your Anxiety and Your Personality, because sometimes something just isn't for you. And it's not that it's just your anxiety holding you back all the time. And if you deny your personality, sometimes you create anxiety.
Yes,
which I think
course.
Is really important. So, you know, I spend a lot of time by myself. I pencil in a lot of downtime. I have to decompress. I might come across like an extroverted person, but I think someone referred to as ambivert, so I charge introvertedly. I need quiet time. I don't like talking all the time as much as I'm talking so much now. Like, tonight when I go to bed, like, I won't even want to chat to my husband on the phone. Like, I just want just my own headspace. I want to come back to zero. And I know that I have to kind of work, if like right now, obviously I'm over here, I know it's full throttle, but when I go home, I'm gonna consciously pencil in time to take my foot off the gas. So it's just about, you know, working with it, ebbing and flowing, leaning in and then leaning back out again.
Yeah. Doing what you have to do.
Doing what you have to do, and knowing yourself. And it's never worth me getting to the point of burnout again. No job, no number one bestseller, nothing is worth compromising that. And unfortunately, I feel like a lot of people have to get to the point of burning out before they realize that.
Yeah.
So I just know now what's important to me. And the biggest motivator to me, above money, above success, above nice clothes, is feeling well.
Yeah. And I think if they pick up a copy of your book, that will intervene before they get to the point of...
That's my hope, yes. Is that I can help people get to that point, or avoid getting to that point, that black pit of despair, and help them realize that it's normal, and it's not some foreign bug that's taken over them, and they're not crazy, and they're not alone, and they've not lost their mind, and they're not stuck this way, and, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I know from the book so far that I have had that impact, and that's just the most rewarding feeling in the world. And I guess in a way it does make it worth it that I went through what I went through.
Yeah. And so I'm going to put you on the spot now.
Okay.
She's looking at me like, what? So tell me, what is next for you, whether it be personal or in your career? What can we expect to be next? Because the book has come out here in the US, and that's obviously a phenomenal achievement. But the books have come out in Ireland a little while ago, and you followed up with your second book. What else is on the cards? What else do you want to achieve for yourself, or would like to?
Both books are going to come out over here and in Canada, and I would, you know, obviously the wellness aim is my core value, but I do have motivation as a journalist and as a writer. I would like to have an impact over here. I would love for it to have a grassroots effect and take off. That was kind of one of my big focuses this year. I'm writing my third book towards the end of this year, which will come out next year. And I also think I got married last year, and we're kind of thinking maybe in the next few years we might think about starting a family. And
oh, that's,
you know,
so cute. I love
yeah
that.
And like the thing is, and I know sometimes people say like, oh, why would you say that before it happens, because like, what if something happened? But like, you know,
you kind of have to.
You can try everything. Yeah. And it might, you know, I might not get lucky, I might be very fortunate, we might have issues, but I think I'm getting to the point where, you know, I know what's important, and like love and family, mm-hmm. and you know, those things are really my core values. So, you know, we might go that way. But I always want to keep writing, and I have other ventures as well. I have an interiors company at home that is doing really well, and so I'm not just Little Miss Anxiety, although someone did refer to me as that one day. They were like, I have a question for the anxiety girl. And I was like, oh God, that's my personal brand now. but I want to, my biggest motivation is to kind of maintain what I'm doing. Like, I feel so lucky. Like, I'm, you know, I write features, I write books, I get to go and give talks to people about anxiety, I get to connect with people like that,
yeah,
whether it's on social media or whether it's in front of someone and or going into an office and helping them change their culture around anxiety, or around, you know, looking after staff and just really
spreading the message.
Yeah, like, you know, like the Arianna Huffington thing of the third metric of, you know, success and power are always the traditional markers of success, but well-being is the third metric, and that is probably more crucial than anything else. And we need to realize that ourselves, but also, like, from the top down in corporate environments, that needs to be not just, you can't just throw in a bloody foosball table and say, oh, we look after our staff, they have a bit of downtime. It has to come, it has to be coming from every direction, that we're all prioritizing our well-being. And so I do feel like a little bit like I want to champion that, and if I can make an impact in some small way with the books or my writing or my talks or my podcast, which I have an anxiety podcast as well, then that's, I don't really have any other end goal. I just, yeah, want to keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, you're passionate about the message then, obviously, yeah, you know, I mean, we didn't doubt that, but it just goes to show, it's like you're passionate about the message and even to change some people's lives, which I think you've changed more than you realize.
I don't know.
I think you have. Personally, I know, but that's amazing. It's just, it's phenomenal for me. And that's what attracted me to you was like, this girl is doing her own, like she has her own message, and it's she's really owning it, like, I don't want to be cheesy, but it's the truth. And it's like, that's the whole ethos of what I want to talk about on this podcast, is that message that you're just so passionate about, because it's so authentic, because you've lived and breathed it, you know. And it's just so
real. And I'm really
to
fortunate
you.
You know, not many people can turn what they believe in so much, yeah, or feel passionate about into their career,
yeah.
And I mean, it is tough, I mean, you know, but it's like I'm not rolling in money or anything, but especially in Ireland, book money is nothing, and
yeah,
it's all profile, and it's a lot of work and a lot of kind of front loading and work up front, a lot of networking. But I
still get to work on that.
I still get to work on it, but also I want people to know that, you know, if you're working in a job that's literally just paying the bills and you're not loving it, you know, have a side hustle that you can just put in some passion into it. I think it's just so important to just indulge that side of yourself. Or, you know, whether it's going to more events or even volunteering or just making a difference in one person's life, or
yeah,
something that just kind of floats your boat. I think it's very easy to get caught up into this world of just the monotony. And I think, like, your whole...
It doesn't have to be that way.
No, but your whole message of you know, people having that one thing that they believe in, or that directs their journey in some way. We all have one, and it's just about kind of finding out what that is. And I've just been fortunate to find mine, I guess, so young.
Yeah.
I'm not that young, though. In my 30s now.
Well, you're still young. Don't be saying that on this. People will be giving out. Yeah, no, I that's exactly what it is. It's finding that thing that's your core value and kind of just going with it.
Yeah.
It's such a vulnerable position to be in, and it can really open you up. But the more vulnerable it is, it's like you can't go any further with you. Like, nobody can do anything else to you, because you've given it all. You've opened yourself up and you said, this is it.
Well, like, yeah, and it's kind of a defense mechanism, I suppose, sometimes, like, vulnerability, what I would have thought as
you're calling yourself out,
is actually makes me invulnerable, ironically. And it's sort of, vulnerability becomes my biggest strength and my superpower.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't get to that point.
I know, it's scary, but you have to just be willing to look in the mirror. And I also have no filter, which helps.
Yeah, that's good. I think a lot of people are trying to get to that point. It's actually funny, you know, and a good example is in the movie 8 Mile with Eminem.
Mm.
When he raps, he calls himself out, because they all don't like him because he's white.
Yes,
he calls himself out and he says that he's this and he's trash and he lives in a trailer park. And that's one example I often hear in the media of, like, just being, like, open and vulnerable, especially in the social media, like, such intense world, that people are like, oh, her hair is... like, her blonde is not a cool blonde, it's a warm blonde, and it's, you know, and people get so detailed. Oh, the way she talks, I don't like the way she talks, she uses her hands too much, and this and that, and you're just like, jeez, you're just opening yourself up.
I know. There's a fine line, though, between being vulnerable. I know I'm rambling on now, but being vulnerable doesn't mean being weak. It can mean just being authentic and being yourself. And being vulnerable doesn't have to mean being self-deprecating, which can go the other way sometimes. You know, like, I'm vulnerable by saying, oh, I'm going out here to America to give it a go. That's being vulnerable. I don't need to be vulnerable by saying, oh, I'm a crap writer, or, you know, or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like that's I think we're so used to thinking of self-deprecation as being a nice person, but actually sometimes you're just talking yourself down, or you're not doing yourself any service. And it's important to be like, yes,
I know what I am,
but I know what I am, and I know that I have qualities and, you know, positive things that make a difference to the world.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's it. That's the moral of the story.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephanie.
It was great to have the chat with you, and to be my very first guest on the podcast.
Congrats on the podcast. I'm so excited for all your future episodes.
I know.
You did it.
I know.
You
I did it. I broke the seal. Now I'm like, I'm not going to sleep tonight.
You broke the wall, your own wall.
That's it. It was my little own wall. Yeah. That's true. I never even thought of it.
Yeah,
it's been going on a year. So yeah, then my own little wall. Well, thank you so much. You've been amazing. And I'm so excited for the future,
thank
for everything.
You.